Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is James Petras. Lots to discuss with Jim today. I suggested to Jim ahead of the program, ahead of airtime, that we focus on two topics. One is what's going on in Venezuela right now. Oh, when things happen in Venezuela, I generally jump on it. Over the years, I've written a great deal about Venezuela, and Jim is an expert. So who better to have on today to talk about what's going on in Venezuela than Jim? And he's certainly, I'm eager to hear his comments, because there is a lot of violence going on in the streets. It was instigated some days ago, early in February. It continued through yesterday. I don't know what's going on this morning. Things usually rather quiet early in the morning. They can pick up later in the day. But the name of the game is what it's always been with America. Washington's dirty hands are involved in this, just like they always are. Washington has waged a 15-year war, you could call it that, to get rid of a Bolivarianism under Chavez, now under Nicolas Maduro, and the dirty beat goes on. So this is what really is happening. I think, thankfully, and I certainly hope it's true, the great majority of Venezuelans want nothing to do with what's going on, but radicalized students were enlisted. You've got fascist elements in the country that are stoking this kind of stuff. They're getting funding from Washington. They're getting support, probably training. We'll talk about that. And another big issue for me, I'm writing about both of these today, is the so-called peace talks in Syria. My goodness, we had round one back in January. Round two is wrapping up either today or maybe tomorrow if they extend it to another day. So far, I think on the 22nd of January they began. About 5 days of talks each session. UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi says there'll be a third round. No date has been decided. Nothing whatsoever has been accomplished in the first two rounds, because the other side, which speaks for Washington, wants regime change. Well, international law wants something else. It says only the people in the country have a right to decide who will govern them, who will lead them, and nobody from the outside can interfere in any way. Jim, I think maybe that's a decent warm-up. Let me let you jump in on Venezuela.
Well, Steve, I'm glad you raised the Venezuelan issue, because what's at stake is not merely a conflict in Venezuela, but it has hemispheric implications, because Venezuela has been a leading force in defending Latin American integration, opposing military coups, imposing the U.S. Backed death squads in Honduras, and beyond that, I think it serves as a reference point for all of the social movements in Latin America because of its advanced social programs, and I think that's the key. Venezuela's earnings from its oil wealth has gone overwhelmingly toward new housing, free general universal health care, free higher education, the construction of several dozen advanced centers of study, including new universities, technical schools, etc., and in general has been a pro-people, pro-poor people government, and reversing decades of pillage by the major oil companies in terms of extracting most of the wealth and parking it in overseas banking accounts. And I think from the very beginning of Chavez's presidency and subsequent to Maduro, the current president, there's been consistent and determined efforts by Washington to overthrow the government, beginning with Clinton and then Bush and now with Obama. And it has to do with two things. First of all, Venezuela refused to support the so-called war on terror. They said there's no basis for launching a global crusade using drones and other instruments to assassinate people, engage in large-scale warfare, when the problems are basically social and economic. And for opposing this worldwide crusade, the United States intervened and supported a military coup in 2002, which was defeated as over a million people came down and defended the government along with the sector of the paratroops. Then they went for a lockout. The oil managers and directors tried to sabotage the economy, and the sector of the oil workers, with the support of the vast majority, defeated that. Then the U.S. went for a referendum. It was resoundingly defeated. Chavez won the next 12 out of 13 elections. And more recently, and I think this is the precipitate for this violence that we're talking about today and yesterday, they had elections, first for the presidency, which Chavez's supporter Maduro won, and then they had municipal elections, which were resoundingly won. And I think Washington and its cohort in Venezuela realized that there's no way they could change the government and the policies through elections. And I think that's what's precipitated this violence. Since they can't win by ballots, they're going for bullets. And the press coverage has been abominable. I mean, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, BBC, they're all putting this as some kind of a simple protest by the opposition, which has been violently confronted by the authorities, etc. If in the United States a group of rioters burned down five patrol cars, threw Molotov cocktails at federal buildings, accosted demonstrators that were supporting the government, killed two of them, there'd be the most heavy-handed repression that Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, or any other city would have experienced. There'd be scores of demonstrators killed, wounded, and thousands of them jailed. And here is the U.S. and international media chastising the government for disturbing so-called peaceful protesters. Peaceful protesters with Molotov cocktails in both hands. So I think what's involved here, Steve, is which way for Latin America? Is it going to be the return of coups, U.S. successful U.S. intervention, the return of regressive social policies pillaged by the economic elites, or is Latin America going to have an example in Venezuela in which the vast majority of the people are the beneficiaries of government budgets?
Oh, indeed, Jim. And I mean, these people are so violent, and they're being manipulated as students. Well, I think the vast majority of students in Venezuela, and probably in most countries, want no part of street violence or anything like what's going on in Venezuela now. So you have a relatively small number in a number of areas across the country, in the capital of Caracas, in the other cities. And as you say, I mean, they're causing all kinds of trouble. In one state, they broke into the governor's. I don't know how they ever got past the gates, but they broke into one governor's house. They threatened his wife. Just imagine something. If somebody broke into City Hall in Chicago and threatened the mayor, my God, I mean, the cops would shoot these people dead on the spot.
You could hear the machine guns rattling. You would hear the machine gun, Rahm Emanuel. Governor's, the mayoral guard would open fire with both barrels.
And the media would support all of it to get rid of these rabble rousers.
Yes, they'd say terrorists attacking the mayor, which, and when it's in Venezuela, they call them peaceful demonstrators. But the point is, the media, mass media, are totally unreliable. They're totally biased. They're against democracy. They'll back anything by any reactionary power, and some of the more sophisticated will put a gloss on it. They'll say there's conflict on both sides, when in fact the conflict was initiated by these political leaders, a fellow named Lopez, who's openly declared that he's going to overthrow the government, what he calls through the street. But what they're really after, Steve, is to create so much instability as to influence the military to intervene. That's the game. There may be some military officials who are wavering and looking to see how things are going to turn. And if the opposition can mobilize and create so much insecurity, and if the businessmen can provoke more inflation and speculation, there may be military people who will renounce their constitutional commitments and intervene and bring the country toward a kind of Egypt solution that's saying, in the face of chaos and conflict, we're intervening. And if that's not one scenario, the other scenario is they may want to establish in some part of Venezuela an alternative government, a phony flag raising, and invite the U.S. Marines to intervene on behalf of this phony parallel government. So a lot is at stake, Steve. I can't emphasize enough that there is hundreds of millions of people in Latin America looking to see what the outcome is going to be. Because if there's a coup in Venezuela or if the government's overthrown, that's going to be the signal for return of the coups in the rest of Latin America. I remember the coup that took place in Chile was followed by coups in Argentina, Uruguay, etc. It's a coup, and it's clear that Obama has no liking for democracy. He's the genial smile, the guy that shoots hoops in the ghettos, the one that charms the editors of the media. He's a cold-blooded killer.
Jim, there's no question about that. I've said that so many times in the articles that I've written. And my goodness, I mean, he's waging so many direct and proxy wars, including the fact that U.S. Special Forces operate in over 120 countries worldwide. And they don't go over there. They go over there covertly. They're not goodwill ambassadors. These people are trained killers. They go over to destabilize. You get CIA agents operating virtually everywhere, and their game is destabilization and so on. And in independent countries like Venezuela, it really is destabilization for regime change. I think you're absolutely right, Jim. Venezuela is a linchpin of Bolivarianism, or you could simply call it social justice, the kind that every country should have everywhere. And if Venezuela gets toppled, it's open season on everybody else. So it's very, very important that Venezuela survive. I'm very concerned about the military also. If I remember, Jim, in 2002, some high-ranking military men came down on the side of the coup plotters, Pedro Carmona and the others, but through the middle ranks, the junior officers, maybe some others a little bit higher up, they were not supportive of the coup, and they're the ones that joined with the people, the mass protests on the streets, and after 48 hours, literally brought Chavez back from the dead. I'm certain back then, if they could do it all over again, they'd have gotten rid of Chavez on the spot, so there was no revival, but they didn't do it. And 48 hours later, he was back at the Miraflores presidential palace as Venezuela's president. But it's been a 15-year war, Jim, to get rid of him, to get rid of Bolivarianism.
And the great majority of the people that have received homes and subsidized food and jobs and all the improvements in life are getting fed up with this kind of right-wing violence and shooting up their neighborhoods. They really are pulling on the leash, and President Maduro is telling them not to be provoked into violence, but he has to take forceful action. He's got to get these thugs off the streets, because what I'm afraid of, Steve, is that the mass of Venezuelan poor will come out in the street and take these guys on in a kind of civil war. And I think that in that case, there's going to be a lot of people dead, and they're not all going to be supporters of Chavez. So far, President Maduro has been extremely cautious and, in my opinion, overly tolerant of these kind of violent rioters that are disrupting society and everyday life of working people. And I know from my visits in some of the neighborhoods, the people there are very, very grateful for what the government's done. They're very much in tune with defending the achievements they've accomplished, and also of supporting a democratic government where they can vote and elect in the kind of policies they want. And I think the danger is, unless the government comes down with a strong law and order position, the people in the local neighborhoods are going to take it upon themselves to impose a kind of popular justice, and they're not going to be as kind to these right-wing demonstrators and upper-middle-class students that are pillaging and torching some of their local offices, community facilities. This is something they fought a long time to get, and they're not going to simply fold their hands and watch these thugs run over them.
Jim, there'd be some terrible bloodletting if this kind of stuff happens. And these street thugs and the fascists that are manipulating them, they've got weapons. I mean, they would have no compunction at all about really creating all kinds of bloodshed and violence. And there have been 4 deaths, as far as I know, and maybe 5-6 dozen people injured, maybe 5-6 dozen people arrested. I think if I were Maduro, I would try. I mean, Venezuela has good intelligence. They know that the people that are involved in this are a good many. They should go after them, get them arrested, put them in jail. If they have get evidence, prosecute them on these charges, and put them away. And I mean, it's great to be as nonviolent as possible, but they have to put this thing down. If they don't and they let this thing fester, it could go out of control, and then there's a real, real potential for a bad situation.
Yes, Steve, let's remember how the Nazis took over the streets before they took over the government.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's a question, is democracy in Venezuela capable of taking on the fascists, or are they going to allow them to continue and escalate their violence? I think the only solution is to slap them down now before they begin to create insecurity and fear among the population. I think that's the other issue. When you're dealing with totalitarians that refuse to abide by the democratic rules, who lose in elections but think they can win it back through thuggery, you're not dealing with your run-of-the-mill opposition. These people are a combination of Nazis and Ku Klux Klaners. One of the things I noticed in Venezuela is the tremendous hatred that many of these people had toward President Chavez, who was an Afro-Venezuelan, very deeply committed to African heritage and equality for all Venezuelans. They used to portray him as a guerrilla. So there's a real race question here, and it's ironic that Obama, who claims to be Afro descent, is supporting the Ku Klux Klaners in Venezuela. And any claim that he has of standing up for African-descended people is absolutely fraudulent. He has been on the side of the Venezuelan Klaners for a long time. I don't mean they run around in white sheets. They run around with Molotov cocktails and engage in the most virulent kind of racism.
Oh, indeed, Jim. We could spend the rest of the program talking about Venezuela. Let's get a second topic in and talk about what's going on in Syria, because there's an all-out proxy war going on, and I make no bones about it. It's Obama's war. He launched it. It was planned long before he came into office. Again, the name of the game is exactly the same thing. Get rid of an independent government, put a pro-Western proxy, a puppet one, in its place, and the name of the game is get rid of Assad, just the way it is to get rid of Maduro. It's street violence in Venezuela. It's all out proxy war, killing tens of thousands of Syrians, displacing as many as 9 million of them. About a third of the country has been displaced. The human misery and suffering is absolutely off the scale in Syria. Jim, the peace talks are going nowhere, and I honestly don't see them going nowhere. And I just call them fake, because I think, again, the name of the game is regime change. So you certainly don't want to resolve the conflict. You want to stoke it, and I think that's what's going on.
Well, Steve, and also this opposition, there's nothing democratic about it.
The
majority fighting forces, the most violent and aggressive, are affiliated with al-Qaeda. which Washington has had an off and on relationship for the last 25 years in different permutations. I think the question is, who is the opposition? I mean, they have all sorts of Wahhabis and the Salafis and Al-Qaedas, and they have some Western-backed opposition, etc. And the people in the media here do not discuss the fact that that Syria had elections. The opposition, the peaceful opposition that's in the country, participated in those elections, and the Bashar Assad government got a majority. And I think the solution is not for to destroy the current government by fiat or by Western-backed, Western and Saudi-backed terrorists. It's to create conditions, normalize relations, disarm, and enter into negotiations over free elections. And I think that's the way to go in a conflictual situation. The best way is to let Bashar Assad stay in office with advisors from the opposition, convoke elections, ensure that there will be no interference by the West in the elections, either channeling money or financing media, and then accept the outcome of the election.
Oh, exactly, Jim. Unfortunately, Washington really does not want to have elections held because independent polls show that Assad is overwhelmingly popular, just the way Gaddafi was overwhelmingly popular in Syria, astonishingly overpopular. So if he ever had a free election, it certainly will go the way Washington does not want it to go. So, you need to beat up on your enemy and vilify him as much as possible and then just get rid of him. The ideal is, just kill him and get rid of him and get somebody else in its place. But the suffering that's been going on in Syria for 3 years, almost 3 years now, began in early March in 2011. We're coming up on the three-year mark very, very shortly. And it is really horrific what is going on. I simply can't imagine Syria, a country of about 27 million people, and over 9 million are displaced either internally or in neighboring countries. And many of them are suffering. You hear a lot in the news, Jim, about the humanitarian crisis in homes. Well, there are lots of places that have humanitarian crises ongoing. Homes is only one of many, and it certainly isn't because of Assad. It's because of these insurgents. They're not rebels, and there's no civil war going on. These are U.S. death squads imported from foreign countries, and they're the ones causing the problem. And I agree with Syria's foreign minister, Walid al-Molan, Jim, who says there are no moderates fighting Syria in the country, and he's right. You've got these extremist death squad types, the Al-Qaeda types, the Al-Nusra types. You've got different groups that you never heard of before. They make up their own names, and they're not in Geneva. They're not talking about peace. They don't want peace. They don't want war, and the Syrian National Council delegates, SNC delegates, they're phonies. They're U.S.-appointed people. They're U.S. stooges. Their lips move, but Washington policy comes out.
Yes, Steve, and I think it forms a pattern here. The U.S., the neocons, the liberals, first they attacked Iraq on phony pretenses. They had weapons of mass destruction, which everybody has to remember. It was a phony pretext. Then they destroyed Libya. When I say destroyed, I mean literally, because they didn't bring in a new government to develop the economy. No, they destroyed a developing economy, oil-based, that was funding an extensive African development programs that was developing a highly efficient welfare program. So here goes Iraq, the most modern country, ruled by a dictator, but certainly a very developed, scientifically-based country, and turned it into a war zone by pitting Sunnis against Shias. Now they're after Syria. After Syria is Lebanon. After Lebanon is Iran. I mean, there's a whole pattern here that the U.S. government is pursuing of destroying adversaries and putting nothing in its place that's viable, consensual, and capable of maintaining minimum living standards. And part of this offensive is fueled by the Israel and pro-Israel lobbies in the United States, who see these countries as alternatives, not alternatives, as supporters of the Palestinians. So as these wars go on, Israel swallows more and more of Palestinian territory. Their supporters in the United States support extending and deepening these wars. And I think we have to put our foot down and say, look, more wars mean more refugees, more displaced people, more destruction, more instability, and less resources that can be used to develop the region, that can lower energy prices, that can provide us with markets, which allow us to generate better-paying jobs in the United States. Wars don't create jobs. They destroy treasuries.
Oh, so true, Jim. Absolutely true. And America spends multi-trillions of dollars killing and destroying things, and popular needs at home go begging. The richest country in the world operates this way. It's also the most lawless. It's responsible for the greatest amount of human suffering in human history. It's by far the world's greatest human rights abuser. I could go on and on, Jim. It certainly gives us plenty to write about. It also gives us plenty of heartburn and stomach acid. I can barely contain myself. I don't know how I go to sleep at night, Jim, because this is what I work on, this and many topics related to it, every single day, writing articles and discussing it on this program, on many interviews that I get on a regular basis. And yet somehow I manage to turn it off at night and get to sleep. Not always. Sometimes I roll around, something is on my mind, and I just can't shake it. But this is what America really stands for, and this is what it does. I think what bothers me the most, Jim, is that most people, even those who understand what's going on and certainly don't want any of this, they're simply indifferent. They don't do anything to stop it. And if people don't rise up against this thing and literally get in the activist fight to stop these atrocities going on committed by their government, it's going to get worse and worse. And dare I say, Jim, I think there's a real chance at some point we risk the possibility literally of World War III.
Well, Steve, I got to agree with most of what you're saying, but there is a tide of opposition to new wars. There's clearly, all the polls reveal, the American people are fed up with the war in Afghanistan. They don't want the U.S. to start a new war. They opposed the bombing of Syria, which was on Obama's agenda. They have supported initiatives to negotiate a settlement with Iran. AIPAC, the American-Israel political action, is still formidable, but they weren't able to undermine the opening negotiations with Iran. I think people are becoming more active in their opposition. I agree with you that people are not doing enough, but I think the tide is shifting. But what were sacred cows before, like Israel, like Obama, like the military complex, they are now being seriously questioned because people see not only the injustice and immorality, but how it's affecting their pocketbook. And I think the linkage between overseas wars and domestic immiseration is becoming clear to more and more people. It's a question now of developing and presenting a political format for this opposition to express itself.
Jim, I absolutely agree with you. The only thing that bothers me is, unlike the 1960s and early 1970s, we don't see these people in the streets the way they were against the Vietnam War. And that's what I'd really like to see. I know the polls are very, very anti-war. The anti-war sentiment on the Afghanistan War, I quoted this in an article some weeks ago, is greater than at the height of the Vietnam War. It's astonishing. Over 80% of Americans oppose America's involvement in the Afghanistan War. And my only complaint is, Why aren't they out in the streets opposing it?
Well, that's a good question, Steve, but I think you played a formidable role in educating at least that sector of the public, which is access via blog.
And oh, Jim, you must kind of feel like a voice in the wilderness, and the music is saying, I've got to get off
here. I don't think so, Steve. I think more and more people are becoming aware thanks to some of your writing.
Jim, bless you. I look forward to getting you back to continue this. Maybe one day we'll have a topic to discuss about how wonderful things are. Many, many thanks, Jim.
Okay, thank you for inviting me, Steve. Bye.